Beis Hashem, I'm going to try to speak a little bit about the experience that I had there in Berlin. The first part will be a little bit of an overview of what I gleaned from there in terms of a little bit of Jewish history. And the second part, I'll speak about the yeshiva. There are two questions which bother us about the Holocaust. Two questions, which I think, which bother us as Americans, and became a little bit more clarified when I was there. One of the questions that everyone asks is, Nazi Germany, Yimach Shemam V'Zichram, they came to power in 1933, and for 6 years there was propaganda against the Jews about how bad they are, and it was not a pretty situation. Boycott of shops. B'chule, b'chule. And one of the questions that comes to mind is why didn't more Jews leave? Didn't they see the handwriting on the wall? Why didn't more Jews leave? There were Jews that left. When it started getting very bad in 1938, 39, they started to leave. But not everyone left. Why not? So it's a perplexing question. We see all the propaganda and it was so terrible. Why didn't they leave? That's question one. The second question is really just more of a hesber. Rav Huttner Zatzal was very against calling the Holocaust the Holocaust. He wanted it to be referred to as the Churban of Europe. The Churban of Europe. He did not want it to be called the Holocaust. Why not? What's wrong with that term? And so the Gedolim seemed across the board, they didn't like this term, the Holocaust. They wanted to call it the Churban of Europe. And the question is, what's wrong? What's wrong with that term, the Holocaust? So Be'ez Hashem tonight, we're going to try to, in giving the overview, I think these two questions will be a little bit more clear. Where this became clear to me is when I was in Berlin, there's a Jewish history museum that opened up approximately 5 years ago. It's interesting, this museum is really known more for its architecture. One of the architects that got the contract to rebuild the area around the Twin Towers is actually Peter Lipskin, I think his name is, or Peter Lipskin. He designed the Jewish Museum of Berlin. He got an architectural award for it. A whole very interesting design. It's a broken mug and dove. I don't have such a head for these things. It's a broken mug and dove. It's all different tunnels around. It's a very interesting design. But he got an award for it. It's designed to show the history of Yidden in Ashkenaz, in Germany. And of course, the focus at the end is on the Holocaust. Now, personally, I didn't like the way they did the part in the Holocaust. It was only what I saw in the display. Was only one line at the end, where actually in the entry into the museum, about 6 million Jews were killed. In the actual display, they didn't mention it. I didn't feel there were enough gory pictures depicting what was going on there. Now, this museum was really made for Germans. It was not made for Jews. It was really not made for Jews. Because there was all different Jewish artifacts about, Jewish customs and so on. The one thing they had which was interesting, in terms of Jewish artifacts, they had an old, what they called the Jewish oven. If you look in Chela Gimel Mishneh Berurah, the Mishneh Berurah talks about the old ovens that they had. So this looked like one of them. One of these old Jewish ovens from 150 years ago. So that was a shtickle interesting. But otherwise, that very basic stuff. It wasn't anything, no big kiddush. But the Holocaust part, I personally thought was done pretty poorly. I didn't like it. The part that was, to me, very interesting was the history of Yidden before the war in Ashkenaz, in Germany. And that's what I want to talk about. Because some interesting parts become revealed there. So let's take a timeline. Let's take a little bit of a timeline through Jewish history, and let's see what we come up with. They had some very interesting facts. Number one, Jews lived in Germany as early as they have read, one of the artifacts which seems to prove this, from the 4th century, which means that already 300 years after the Churban Bayis Sheni was in 70 CE, about 300 years later, Jews were living in Germany. They found a jug, an artifact, which had the symbol of a menorah on it. And they apparently have records of Jews living there from that time. which tells us something about the magnitude of the tragedy of the Holocaust. That means close to 1,600 years of Jewish life was wiped out by the Nazis in Auschwitz. Amazing thing. 1,600 years Jews lived in Germany. It's a long time. Kimat from close to the Bayis Sheni. Rabbi Fishman told me, may even be before that. He said there's some Ariel, some of that even from Bayis Rishon Jews lived in Germany. That I don't know. But there they had a record, at least from after 300 years after the Churban, the Jews were living there already. Okay. Ad kedei kach, some of the streets in Germany where the Jews lived were actually named by Jewish names. Strasse in German is street. So there are certain streets in small towns which are named Judenstrasse, the street where the Jews lived. Or synagogue plots. Plots in German is a square. Synagogue plots. This is the square of the synagogue. And in the museum they reported that the reason why it got those names was because the Jews founded those areas. They were the first ones to be there. It was called Judenstrasse because the Jews settled there. Which tells you something about how far out, what kind of history was that, how long Jews lived there. It was called Judenstrasse, that's what it was named. So that's one point about how long the Jews lived in Germany. But there's another part here, which is interesting, historically, which is that already from then, it seemed like Jews were already excluded from living in certain areas. They already couldn't live wherever they wanted. So Yidden had to go to certain areas, farm out new areas and to live there, because they were excluded from certain inhabited areas already. The Goyim already decided Jews aren't welcome. So it could be that would be another reason why Jews, let's say, certain areas were pushed, founded by Jews. The community itself, certain cities, were founded by Jews because they were excluded from other areas. So this is in terms of the beginning of the history of Jews in Germany, in terms of where they lived. What kind of jobs did they have in those times? It seems already even from then that a lot of trades were excluded for Jews. Let's say they had certain unions, let's say blacksmiths or so on. They weren't allowed to enter certain trades or to go to certain schools even to learn those trades. It was already excluded. So what jobs did Jews get? Number one, money lenders. Cash. What?
Real estate.
Real estate. Oh, real estate. Okay, real estate. Real estate. Interesting enough, it's interesting you mentioned real estate. There was a Rebbe, this is a little bit of a sideline. There was a Rebbe in Europe, there was a Chassidus in Europe pre-war, which was called Radomsk. I don't know if anyone ever heard of it. Radom, what? Tereshleiman. Tereshleiman was a Radomsky Rebbe, right? Good. Tereshleiman. Very choshev a sefer, Chassidus sefer on Chumash. The Radomsky Rebbe had a whole network of yeshivas in pre-war Europe, about a network of 50 yeshivas, which he himself supported. The Rebbe himself supported these yeshivas. The Rebbe had one son, one daughter, and she married a fellow named Rav Moshele. This Rav Moshele was known as a Goyin Otzim before the war. Chaim Oizer, pre-World War II, already said he was a Goyin Otzim. The Goyin HaGoyin, this is from Chaim Oizer Grzenski, said about Rav Moshele that he was a Goyin Otzim. He was the Radomsky Rebbe's son-in-law. And this Rav Moshele used to go around to all the Radomsky yeshivas for Herring Bochum, giving Bochum tests. Where did Radomsky Rebbe become such a gvir? Right after World War I, he bought up real estate in Berlin. He bought up mamish parcel of land in Berlin, became a gvir otzim after the war. And that's how he had the money to support all the yeshivas. So it's interesting, same scenario. Okay, I'm going much poorer, but it's not so far. You know, we're always dealing in real estate. Even the Rebbes were dealing in real estate. Good. Akoponim, getting back, okay, let's go, we have to go back to our Talmud. That was in the 1920s. Let's go back. So the Jews were already excluded then from certain trades. So what did they do? Had to earn a pint also. So what did they do? They became moneylenders. Cash. It's not a trade. You didn't have to have a certain trade. It became moneylenders. Now this created certain anti-Semitism. Because let's say the Goyim couldn't pay. So you took over the Goyim's land. He's pretty upset. You're throwing him out of his land. Or certain mashkoinis. So you took certain collateral for loans. You know, it means you took away stuff from the Goyim. So even though it was inevitable, it kind of created certain anti-Semitism on the part of the Goyim. And that's what we have anyone, I don't want to jog anyone's memory in English literature, but, you know, Shylock in The Merchant of Venice, right? Shakespeare, anybody, right? Where did everyone knows. Jews were always money lenders. This was the trade. And the reason why was because they were excluded from other trades. And remember, they were, see, the goyim, this is a whole different shmooze. We are allowed to charge interest to goyim, but not to yidden. So we could. It was talking very favorable parnasa. Now, why it is that way? Taka requires another shmooze, but not for now. So that's one. Or interesting enough, there was another thing which they had. They became traders. They used to go to the Eastern Europe to bring back spices and all different things from Eastern Europe. From the Orient. They used to go to India and other different places to trade stuff there. And what did they also bring back from the Orient? They brought back not just goods, but they brought back the Middle Eastern herbs, had medicinal things. So Yidden ended up becoming doctors for the Prussian emperors. It's very interesting, right? You said the Rambam used to go around being famous, but even others became Poshetag because they had the medicines from the trade, from being traders in Eastern Europe. They had one very interesting picture in the museum of a Yid doing Hakazas, what we call Hakazas Dam in Gemara language, bloodletting to one of the Prussian emperors. From the Bacher I went with me, the Russian Bacher went with me, didn't know what it was. What was he doing? So I had to explain to him, this comes from the Gemara. I was amazed when I saw it. So this is Hakazas Dam. The Gemara describes a keren, like a horn, which they used to pull out the blood with as a way of healing somebody. Now, even though today you'd say, what kind of stupidity is that? But it's not so stupid. Because even then people knew, Yossi, right, that diseases were carried in the blood. That diseases were always carried in the blood. So it was, you figured, just like chemo, how does chemotherapy work? Chemotherapy works, you kill the good cell with the cancer cells too. As a way of getting out all the bad cells, you have to kill the good cells also. Even though, so the same thing would be with bloodletting. In order to take out the disease in the blood, you got to take out the good blood also. So it's not stupid. Right? How, you know, again, today it doesn't work anymore, but there was a chachamah, it wasn't ridiculous. So Yidden developed, because of their exclusion rate from certain trades, they had to do certain things, as like money lenders and become traders. But we already see a pattern. One of the things that the Nazis decreed against was that most professions were barred from Jews. So we're already seeing a pattern of, you know, what the Nazis took later on, many, many years later, was already in place hundreds of years before. That Jews were already excluded from certain trades. One aspect of Nazi ideology, which you see already much prior before in German history. Okay, let's move on. Just as a slide, very interesting. From certain pictures that they had of what life was like in Germany, we see a tremendous makaris for old minhagim, for certain minhagim that we have. Example, we have a minhag, the new Shalim, they do this, the Chassidim still do it today, to take a child who's 3 years old, take him to a Rebbe, and you take him the first day when he turns three, and he goes and he licks his eye, and they put olive bays on, right, on what is it, like where they do it, right? They put honey on the olive bays, and the child licks off honey to see that it's learning is sweet. They had a picture from the 1200s of Yidden doing this, of parents bringing their child to Rebbe. I was amazed when I saw it. I told him, do you know, he didn't know what it is. I told him, the guy, I said, do you know what this is? This is from hundreds of years ago. And this is a minhag that people still have today. We think minhagim sometimes were made up. This is a minhag that's hundreds of years old. Of parents taking children to a Rebbe to go for the first learning to lick, and you see the child licking off food. I know what it was, but licking food off is something to show that learning was sweet. And that was the training that Jewish children from the age of three got. Amazing thing. Another thing, this was also to me very fascinating. Shul, what's a shul? We know the shul is a synagogue, based on Knesset. But the Maisa, where the shul comes from? Where the shul comes from? This is mamash interesting. Shule in German is a school. Shule in German is a school. It seems that the weird shul, what we call the shul based on Knesset, is, you know why? is because at that time, Jewish children used to learn in a Beis HaKnesses. So basically, every shul was a school. So the reason why a Beis HaKnesses became to know as a shul was because in German, a shul really means a school. That's what it served as. The Beis HaKnesses, every local Beis HaKnesses served as a cheder, as a yeshiva. So to him, it's funny, to the guy who took me out who said he knew German, to him it was Poshet. He said, yeah, of course, a shul is a school in German. I said, do you understand what this is? The definition of a shul is not a Beis HaKnesses, it's not a shul. It's a school. That was very fascinating to me. The word shul really comes from a school. Okay, because that's how a school, a synagogue, served as a place of learning for kids. Very interesting. The other thing I saw, which also in terms of, you know, Jewish, so the Jewish minhagim and the commitment, this is not Jewish, this is Mamash Halacha. They had a picture of an old mikveh in one of the German towns. Now, we have a whole system of collecting rainwater, but that's how we do it, in order to make sure that we have that water that doesn't go into a kli. The halacha is, in order to be kosher mikveh, you have to have water that was never went into any utensil. Right? They didn't do that then. They had to have a mikveh next to a source, or really a well. So they had a picture of a mikveh. The way the mikveh looked is they had like a series of 40 steps all the way down to a puddle of like where a well. Water that was mamish in the ground where a woman went to be tovel. So she had to walk down, and I think I counted, I remember I saw it, like there's 18 steps, and then there was another circular step, like circular stairway, another 15 steps, till you got to the welcome on mikveh. Could you imagine how cold this was in the winter? Imagine how cold it was. It wasn't freezing there. I don't know if there was heat down there. 40s, mamish, like mamish below underground, it gets pretty cold there. This is what women used to be toiling in. Today, Baruch Hashem, it's heated, we have no problem with this, but this Nimsius Nefesh that women had for the mitzvah of mikveh is half of a fell. I mean, we hear stories about Bobas having to chop away the ice, you know, in Russia to go be toivel, to call on a mikveh. But this is, you know, and I saw it, it's an amazing thing. You see the Nimsius Nefesh that women had to be Mekayim this mitzvah. The Imam is freezing and unfreezing cold mikveh all the way down where there's no heat, and to still go and to be toivel. Amazing thing. Okay. So this is just certain things in reference to mitzvahs and minhagim, which to me very fascinating. Let's go back now to history for a second. Okay, so we started with the Yidden settling in Germany, you know, settling in new towns, and we spoke about the certain trades they have. Now we get to the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages is approximately 1,000 to 100. And then we start with the Crusades, the Holy Crusades. What was that? Could be the Olam is familiar. The Crusades, the German Christians decided to be Gewaltic. You know, when the Goyim get frum, it's very bad news for us. We see that in Iran, you know. Apparently, when the Goyim get religious, they decide either to blow up Jews. And of course, they promised, who knows what they're in Shemayim, Hamed and Yovin. You know, the Arabs have a whole, everyone knows what they promised. It's amazing. Yeah. So when they get frum, it's very bad news. They decided to liberate Germany, to liberate Eretz Yisrael at the time from what they called the Muslim infidels. Right? At that time, Muhammad already started his religion. The Muslims lived in Eretz, inhabited Eretz Yisrael at the time. So they decided they're going to go redeem, they're going to get rid of Eretz Yisrael of the Muslims who, you know, broke away from their religion. Okay, very nice. But along the way, among these holy crusades, they decided, oh, well, if we're getting rid of the Muslims, we might as well kill the Jews, who are the killers of our God, of JC. Along this path, they wreaked tremendous churban to Jewish communities throughout France and Germany. And now, this has ramifications, halacha l'maisa, today. Because you'll notice, we're going to come, that'll be next week. Next week is Shabbos Mevarchim. Yeah. Now, normally Shabbos Mevarchim, we don't say Avarachamim. Right? That's the meaning, the Avarachamim for Muslims, we don't say. In the period of year when Shabbos Mevarchim comes out, in the month of Iyar and Sivan, we do say Avarachamim. Even if it's Shabbos Mevarchim. You know why? Because the period of the Crusades happened at this time. And the tefillah of Avarachamim was Niskan specifically for this tragedy. It was set up, it was Niskan, it was created for this tragedy. If you look at the tefillah in the Koyim, what the theme of that tefillah is, Nekoyim Nikmas Dama V'dach HaShofuch. We asked the Baruch Hashem to take revenge on the spilled blood of his servants. And it was written as a response to the Holy Crusades. So Mamash has ramifications of Halacha. A lot of the Crusades took place during this time of year. One was Rosh Chodesh Sivan, one was Gimel Sivan. All different communities had suffered tremendous tragedies, you know, during that time. Because they got firm and they decided that the Jews were the killers of JC, and therefore they should take revenge against us. Yeah. Another place where you find it, just interesting, keep it in mind for Tisha B'Av. In Tisha B'Av, many of the kinnis, a little bit or in the middle or towards the end, but some of them have to do with those tragedies that occurred then. In cities like Speyer, Vermeise, Worms in Germany, Vermeise, Magenta, different places in France and Germany where Jews suffered tremendous tragedies at that time. Okay, so that's the Middle Ages. And then a few hundred years later, there was a tremendous plague that spread throughout Europe. It was called the bubonic plague. You've heard of it, the bubonic plague. And of course, the Jews were always the scapegoat. We were accused of poisoning the wells. It's our fault. We poisoned the wells of the water. And that's why this plague existed. So Nachama, another round of pogroms came about. So we're beginning to see that anti-Semitism existed quite well in Germany way before Nazi Germany comes around. But it gets more interesting. Now listen to this. They showed there that as part of their, say anti-Semitism against the Jews, in certain places they forced the Jews to wear a yellow patch as a sign that they're Jewish. And we'll get it? A yellow patch. Rings a bell? This is 600, 700 years before Nazi Germany. Dafke yellow. Yeah? A yellow patch. Hafel digavin. A yellow patch. As a sign that they're Jewish. And other places, they had to wear a pointy hat, which is interesting. I don't know where that comes from. They had to dafke wear a pointy hat. I don't know why. So we already see another aspect of some of the decrees of Nazi Germany, going back way before, hundreds of years before the Nazis come along, in Germany, right? Specific clothing to define Jews as being Jewish. Man, when I saw the yellow patch, I went to my camp. I couldn't believe it. Okay. Now another interesting thing. We said before that Jews were forced out from certain areas. We're not allowed in certain areas. We know, historically, in 1935, a lot of the laws that were enacted against the Jews about where they were, where they're out of work, and things that excluded them from many professions and universities, it was called the Nuremberg Laws. Nuremberg Laws was enacted in 1935. They had on record there that somewhere, I didn't have the exact year, I didn't go back and say, I hopped it later, that somewhere around 1636, around the 1630s, the Jews were thrown out of Nuremberg. They were evicted from the city. Hafel dike hashgacha. That means 300 years later, came out close to 300 years later, that in that same place in Nuremberg, that's where the laws were enacted against the Jews. Okay? Which means there's a pattern here that's developing. It's not an isolated incident. Now let's move on. Now let's move to the 1800s, right? Late 1700s. We get to the period now of reform, which, as and the Olim is familiar, but when the reform started, let me give a little bit of background. Unfortunately, when the reform started, it decimated German Jewry. Decimated. Right? Reform really took Moses Mendelssohn, who was the founder of reform. He himself was a from Yid, you should know. Can't say he was not a Shomer Shabbos. He himself was religious. But he was the forerunner of reform, because he said, Judaism in the house and it should be a German in the street. That was his motto. From that motto, that basic philosophy of embracing German culture, started the reform movement. And they say it so decimated reform Jewry that when Reb Shimshon Elfar Hirsch came back to Frankfurt in the late 1850s, 1860s, he could not find a minion of Shomer Shabbos. he could not find, when he started his Kehillah, he could not find the minion of Shomer Shabbos. That's how decimated Jew and Jewry was. But with this, you can understand why it was so, why Yidden was so desperate to find a way out of anti-Semitism. Jews had been suffering for hundreds and hundreds of years under anti-Semitism. They had hoped that maybe by embracing German culture, finally they would be accepted by the Goyim, and they would get out of the tremendous cycle of anti-Semitism they were suffering. What I'm doing here, Rabbi, is just to figure out, it wasn't Stam Yidden left, you know, Judaism en masse. You know, just, they just decided they were throwing everything away. Yidden had suffered for so many hundreds of years with anti-Semitism. They were looking for a way to, maybe this is going to finally solve our problems. Maybe finally we'll be accepted, we'll be able to live in peace. They won't change, they won't drive us machine. We'll have a normal, able to, you know, we'll be able to live in peace with our neighbors, and we'll be able to, you know, have normal jobs. Just to understand the background of it. It wasn't Stam that Yidden would just decide, okay, we're just throwing everything away. It was hope that this, I mean, we know now that it was quite false. But just you should understand where the historical background is coming from. It wasn't Stam that just Yidden decided to leave Yiddishkeit. Yeah, interesting to note, 4 out of 6, Moses Mendelssohn had, I was actually by his kever in Berlin. He was dead in Berlin. It's interesting. Somehow, only the non-from Jews decided to put up his kever. But that area where he's buried, the Nazis just completely destroyed the Beis HaKvaris, and now it's just grass. Unfortunately, you had, you know, local goyim just sitting on it. It's part of another part of the Churban. You know, it's, you know, a place that we consider very special, the Beis HaKvaris, is now completely desolate. But his kever is still there. And they put it up, at least in my saver they put up. Of his children, 4 out of 6, not just went off the derech, but were baptized. Here, 4 out of 6 children were baptized. That's a paladic thing. See what such an attitude led to. 4 out of 6 became mamish goyim. They became, that's bad. In the stomach, he wouldn't have been happy with it. But Ankidei Kach, it went so far that 4 out of 6 children mamish became Christians. Interesting fact. Huh? The two remained, also they weren't religious. But 4 out of 6 became mamish Christians. Okay. Let's continue even in the 8th age number. He gave it back unto reform. I saw a very interesting picture of, this was in a place called Ichenhausen, a small shtetl in Europe, where apparently the Prussia, as Germany was called then, was governed by certainly, you know, governing princes and governors. So they had a picture there of the local community giving like a present to the emperor, the king of that area. The way the Goyisha artists drew the picture, fascinating. You have the Goyim in front, very tall, and the Jews are in back, smaller, with beards. The men with beards, but smaller and in back. You hear the messages coming through? The implicit message. The Jews are not as chashuv, right? Second-class citizens and distinct-looking. A picture from the 1830s. That's a very strong message to give over. Second-class citizens. Clear. Small inside. Very clear. You can't miss it. Second-class citizens in the back. Yeah. They also imposed it in certain cities where Jews came. Now, you can imagine, say, you had certain cities, you had a tax for, you know, cattle, right? The Germans, certain cities placed on the Jews a body tax that in order to enter the town, you had to pay tax on yourself. Now, how humiliating that is, a body tax. Mine's like a piece of animal. On cattle comes in town, you have to pay tax. When you came into the town, you have to pay a tax. You know how humiliating that is? Body tax. Okay. Mom's like an animal. So this is going on. It even in the 1850s. Now, although at this time Jews did achieve, like I said, during the time of the 1800s, Jews achieved certain measures of freedom, right? And because of that, Yidden became very successful, right? Shipbuilders, some of the biggest department stores in Berlin in the early 1900s were all owned by Yidden. Many of them are in firm, but all owned by Jews. Big amount, I mean, like Macy's, big department stores. Mamish were owned, completely owned by Jews. The biggest shipping companies, the company, this I didn't know, the company AEG today, its foreign was owned by, was made by Yid. So AEG, it still exists today. AEG, it was started by Yidden. So Jews were very successful. However, even then, even when the Jews already got a certain level of freedom and were, so to say, integrated into German society, anti-Semitism still existed. And I'll give you an example. In World War I, Germany fought against the Allied, allied powers, and Germany lost the war. In 1916, 1917, Germany was losing. Comes along the government and says, of course, it's the Jews' fault. Why? Because they shirked the army. They know what they call them, the Jews shirkers. They don't want to go to the army. They don't want to join. It's because they don't want to join the army that the German army is losing. It's their fault. Now, Lamaisa was a sheker for kazev. It's mamash a lie. Because Dafke at that time, German Jews wanted to Dafke show their patriotism to Germany. They were the first ones to join. Because they wanted to show their patriotism to Germany. But they were mamash accused of being shirkers, that they shouldn't be what he called. They weren't the ones that were patriotic enough. But that's what we were accused of. How big a thing? So we already see a background that anti-Semitism has, and this was to me a very big finish, that has a long history from the time that Yidden already were in Germany till basically present day. So now, if you have a history of anti-Semitism, yeah, imagine living yourself in the 1930s in Germany. You know what you probably would have said? You would have said to yourself, you know what, we've had Tsaros in the past. We know that the Goyim hate us, that they really don't like us too much. We'll write it out. Where are we living for? We've lived here for hundreds of years. We've had Tsaros before. We've had pogroms before. The Goyim are crazy now. They're crazy. Okay. They'll do a little sukkah mishigah things, and we'll live and then we'll go weiter. A few Goyim, unfortunately, will be killed. But we'll be able to live on. I think that was the attitude. Because they were so used to living with anti-Semitism, they never envisioned that saw a tragedy of such magnitude could take place. They never imagined it. Lamaisa, at the end of the museum, there was a lady that was talking, a non-from woman, a philosopher, and she said, this was our Lashon. She said, yeah, no, they hated Jews, but her Lashon was, this shouldn't have taken place. This shouldn't have taken place. You know what she was saying? What she was saying was that nobody imagined that this would happen. That there would have been a few people killed here and a few people killed here, and it would be difficult. Yeah, okay, that we understood, because they were used to anti-Semitism already. But that it would be mamish, I could say that the whole Jewish community wiped out. Nobody even called them. Then nobody dreamed. I think that's why when you see a whole picture of what's going on, it's a whole different story. I think that's why also the Gedolim were very mocked in terms of what they called it Churban Europe. Because what when you mention the term the Holocaust, oh, it's late. Okay. When you mention, I'll end with this. When we talk about the Holocaust, what the image it's given over is that it's an isolated incident in the Jewish history. It's one thing. It's a separate thing. It's only about, okay, it's the void. It's separate from all of Jewish history. What you see from history is it's not that way. There was a history of anti-Semitism from years, hundreds of years before that. And the Gedolim, this is the pattern of Jewish history throughout. There'll be times that the Goyim like us, there'll be times Goyim that hate us. This is not an isolated incident. It's part of the history of Yidden throughout Golus. That sometimes the Goyim will be good to us, and there can be times that the Goyim will hate us mamish, and they're going to try to wipe us out completely. Don't take it and disassociate it from the rest of Jewish history. It's part of the cycle of Jewish history. There are times that Goyim like us, and the times that they're very difficult for Jews and Goyim. There are other reasons also, but I think this is very much part of it. It's not a separate, and you see, and again, you see from history, that there was a big part of Nazi propaganda, of what they took, what came from hundreds of years before. They didn't invent it. They took it from hundreds of years before. Which tells us that this is unfortunately another part of the Goyim that we have to solve. And I think that's part of the reasons. Again, not the only reason, there's more. But part of the reason why the Gedolim were very makbid, and you see it, I think it's borne out, that was to me with the Zgala, that why the Gedolim were makbid to call, unfortunately, the Churban of Europe.